Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by SunSounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode, on Thursday, May 2nd, 2024, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. Newly minted American citizens could sway the 2024 election if they vote. Extension of Hobbs Tribal Relations Office stalled by GOP senators. Five more Trump attorneys, aides, publicly named in AZ fake elector indictment. 13 allegations of candidate petition signature forgery forwarded for possible criminal charges. In ethics complaint, Republicans accused two Dems of, quote, insurrection for protesting on the House floor. And let's get started. Newly minted American citizens could sway the 2024 election if they vote. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez, April 23, 2024. More than 100,000 Arizona residents are eligible to become U.S. citizens, and voter mobilization groups are counting on them to make a difference in the upcoming election. The United States Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency estimates that as many as 170,171 lawful permanent residents who call the Grand Canyon State their home qualify for naturalization. And while many of them likely have not yet embarked on the costly and lengthy hurdle that the naturalization process represents, between 2016 and 2020, more than 62,000 people in Arizona did become naturalized citizens. Even that number has the potential to sway election results in a swing state known for tight races. Sid Nicole Melikou, Executive Director of the National Partnership for New Americans. The 2020 election for president in Arizona was decided by just 10,000 votes. So if there's 62,000 newly naturalized citizens here in Arizona, I'm going to ascertain that there's a portion of them that will deeply influence the outcome of this year's election, she told the Mirror on Tuesday morning during a nationwide campaign launched to mobilize naturalized voters. The campaign to recruit newly naturalized voters kicked off on Tuesday, the 14-year anniversary of the signing of SB 1070, Arizona's notorious anti-immigrant Show Me Your Papers law that greenlit racial profiling. Alejandra Gomez, executive director of Arizona Center for Empowerment, highlighted that contrast. She said that while the GOP majority legislature has recently harkened back to that anti-immigrant era by proposing several discriminatory measures this session, Latino advocacy organizations are now better equipped to mount a defense. 14 years ago, I felt caught off guard, Gomez said. Our organizing community was still in development. Today, I do not feel caught off guard. Part of that organizing effort is the annual campaign to connect with newly naturalized voters, which ramps up during election cycle years. Gomez says ACE's sister organization, Living United for Change in Arizona, has committed to knocking on 1 million doors this election cycle. And ACE itself works to connect with voters across the state, coordinating with the Mexican consulate to identify potential voters and launching online advertisements. While ACE has statewide reach, the organization and most other pro-immigrant groups is focused in Maricopa County, where the majority of Latino residents and those eligible to begin the naturalization process live. And according to USCIS, as many as 123,610 lawful permanent residents who qualify for naturalization live in the Phoenix, Mesa, Chandler area. Petra Falcon, the head of immigrant advocacy group Promise Arizona, added that newly naturalized citizens could be a balanced tipping force in the November election and a significant force for change beyond that. In Arizona alone, the outcome of the 2020 presidential election was determined by just 10,000 votes, illustrating not just the power of every vote, but the undeniable influence of new citizens in our electoral landscape, she said. With 177,000 residents eligible for naturalization, our potential to shape the future is immense and growing. While advocates tout the potential influence of naturalized voters in Arizona, the tricky part lies in mobilizing them to begin with. Only about 10% of residents across the country who are eligible to naturalize do so every year. And voting participation among newly naturalized citizens is equally dismal. In 2016, only 54% of naturalized voters cast a ballot, compared to 62% of U.S.-born citizens. Still, Hispanic and Asian naturalized citizens are likelier to vote than U.S.-born Asian or Hispanic voters, signaling that the voting bloc is highly interested in participating. Nedra Sumac, the national field manager for We Are All America, which advocates on behalf of refugees and asylum seekers, urged newly naturalized citizens to take action this election cycle. Sumac, who was a refugee from Bosnia and Herzegovina, said that this year's election is especially important and every vote is crucial. "There is a lot at stake this election year, particularly here in Arizona," she said. "We are facing tremendous issues that are directly impacting our communities. Housing is skyrocketing, and people are losing their homes, ending up on the streets. Inflation is through the roof. We have women's reproductive rights currently under attack." Newly eligible voters can be part of the solution by electing better leaders, Sumac added, instead of politicians who, she said, are more concerned with their careers than with backing helpful policies. "We have people in power who are not in it for the right reason and creating further divisiveness among people and passing legislation that is harming our community," she said. "Many of these elected officials are going to be up for re-election in November." The Arizona legislature is up for grabs this election, along with several seats in Congress that both the Republican and Democratic parties are vying over to cement control at the federal level. Razia Shaliza is one of the newly minted Arizonans who will make her voice heard in November. The 24-year-old fled Afghanistan with her family in 2018 and became a citizen last year. While she hasn't yet registered to vote, she plans to do so before the October 7th deadline, and her top concern is reproductive freedom. The Arizona Abortion Access Act, which is headed for the November ballot, seeks to enshrine abortion as a right in the state constitution, voiding efforts from the Arizona Republicans to ban access to the procedure and nullifying an 1864 near total ban that is set to be re-implemented in June. Now that she's a citizen, Shalizi said she's looking forward to casting her ballot for what she believes in. "I'm going to be voting this year for women's rights," she said. "I wish for all women to have their rights and their freedoms." And 25-year-old Alex Girua is focused on backing pro-immigrant candidates. The native of the Republic of Congo is set to finally become a citizen in June. "As someone who is both an immigrant and who works with other immigrants," Girua said, "hearing hostile rhetoric from lawmakers is disheartening. Once he becomes a citizen," he said, "he plans to be an active voter and inform as many people as he can about which politicians care about and advocate for all Arizonans, no matter their national origin." When I become a citizen, I will start voting, and I will start electing people that are willing to respond to our views or to our feelings, who will respect our dignity and respect us for who we are, he said. And that concludes this story. Newly minted American citizens could sway the 2024 election if they vote. Our next story, extension of Hobbs Tribal Relations Office stalled by GOP senators, by Shandine Silversmith, April 26, 2024. The fate of the Governor's Office of Tribal Relations is unclear after Senate Republicans refused to take up a bill allowing the office to continue operating after June that had received bipartisan backing in the House of Representatives. Because Senator Jake Hoffman, the Republican chairman of the Senate Governance Committee, didn't allow his committee to consider House Bill 2429 before a March deadline, the bill extending the agency for 8 years is dead. Instead, the future existing of the Tribal Relations Office hinges on a late amendment added to House Bill 2632. That amendment proposes extending the work of 8 executive agencies, boards, and commissions, but for just 2 years, and with restrictions on how they operate and what they can do. For instance, the agencies would be prohibited from spending public money or using public resources on critical race theory training. The governor's office said it disapproves of the proposed restrictions, noting that the provisions were not agreed upon by the executive agencies, stakeholders, or the original bill sponsors for HB 2429. The other agencies facing a 2-year extension in the amendment to HB 2632 include the Department of Administration, the state's largest state agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Review Board, the Boiler Advisory Board, the Arizona Board of Technical Registration, and the Arizona State Personnel Board. Jason Chavez, who leads the Governor's Office on Tribal Relations, said that there's still a chance senators will revive HB 2429 and extend his office's operations for 8 years. I am hopeful that they will do so, as Arizona has the third largest Native American population nationally, and tribal lands comprise more than 25% of Arizona's total landmass, Chavez said in a written statement. Governor Katie Hobbs' administration provided that statement to the Mirror in response to repeated requests to interview Chavez. If nothing is done, then the office will shut down on July 1. Tribal relations play a critical role in building an Arizona where everyone can thrive, Liliana Soto, a press secretary for Hobbs, said in a statement. Rather than passing the bipartisan continuation from the House, radical legislators like Jake Hoffman chose to play politics with tribal relations. But the governor will continue her diligent work with tribes and do what's right for Arizona, regardless of this continuation bill, she added. The revitalization of the Governor's Office on Tribal Relations happened in 2023, and Hobbs appointed Chavez, a citizen of the Tohono O'odham Nation from the San Miguel Village in Chukuk District, as the director of the office. The Governor's Office on Tribal Relations was initially established as the Commission of Indian Affairs in 1953, according to Chavez, and it was created to consider and study conditions among indigenous people living within the state. The Office on Tribal Relations builds cooperation between the state and 22 sovereign tribal nations, Chavez said in a statement. Given the significant American Indian population and surrounding tribal lands, the office is critical to creating opportunity for everyone throughout Arizona. The Office of Tribal Relations comprises a tribal affairs advisor, a project coordinator, an executive assistant, and a missing and murdered indigenous peoples coordinator. The governor's office will continue working to pass a clean continuation that protects Arizona tribal relations and allows the strong relationship Governor Hobbs has built with tribal leaders to continue flourishing, Soto said. The Navajo Nation Office of the President and Vice President issued a letter of support for the Governor's Office of Tribal Relations during the committee hearing for Bill HB 2429 in January. With the potential closure looming, the Navajo Nation's President's Office said that cutting off a communication link with tribes in Arizona would be detrimental. This is the tribe's avenue to the state government, and it needs to stay open, said George Hardeen, Public Relations Director for the Navajo Nation Office of the President and Vice President. Closing any office that communicates with tribes will sooner or later be discovered as a mistake, Hardeen added. More than ever, tribes' voices are being heard and listened to. And that concludes this story, Extension of Hobbs Tribal Relations Office Stalled by GOP Senators. Our next story, five more Trump attorneys, aides, publicly named in AZ fake elector indictment. Two more names haven't been officially confirmed, though it's clear they are Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows. By Caitlin Sievers, April 26, 2024. Attorney General Chris Mays has released the names of five more people who were indicted by a grand jury for the part they played in Arizona's 2020 fake elector scheme to keep former President Donald Trump in the White House. Mays announced on April 24th that a grand jury had indicted 18 people, including all 11 fake electors, for their actions related to the fake elector plot. But she did not initially release the names of seven of the 18, since they had not yet been legally served, although it was easy to figure out who some of them were through statements describing them in the indictment. The five additional indictees are Christina Bobb, the Republican National Committee's Senior Counsel for Election Integrity and a former attorney for the Trump campaign, who was accused in the indictment of making false claims of widespread election fraud in Arizona and in six other states. John Eastman, a former Trump lawyer who is facing possible disbarment in California for his attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Boris Epstein, a former Trump aide who is still one of the former president's advisors. Jenna Ellis, a former attorney for the Trump campaign and a conservative media personality who was censured last year for making false statements about the 2020 election and who pleaded guilty in October to a felony charge in Georgia for her attempts to overturn the election results. Michael Roman, a former Trump campaign aide who was also indicted in the Georgia case. The names of the remaining two indictees have not been released, but it's clear from how they are labeled in the indictment that they are Rudy Giuliani, who was described as an attorney for Trump, who was often referred to as, quote, the mayor, and former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. The previously named indictees are Arizona's fake electors, Kelly Ward, former AZ GOP chairman, Arizona Senator Jake Hoffman, leader of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, Arizona Senator Anthony Kern, member of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, Tyler Bauer, Turning Point USA's CEO, Michael Ward, husband of Kelly Ward, Nancy Cottle, a Republican who's been active in local politics for a decade, James Lemon, a failed 2022 U.S. Senate candidate, Robert Montgomery, former chairman of the Cochise County Republican Committee, Samuel Moorhead, former chair of Gila County Republican Party, Lorraine Pellegrino, former president of the Ahwatukee Republican Women, Gregory Safston, former executive director of the AZ GOP. All 18 of those indicted are charged with conspiracy, fraudulent schemes and artifices fraudulent schemes and practices, and forgery, all felonies. The fake electors were indicted by a grand jury on April 23rd for signing bogus documents claiming that they were Arizona's certified electors and that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. Like it did in other states, the Trump campaign urged the fake electors to attempt to keep him in office after he lost to Joe Biden. Trump is identified in the indictment as unindicted co-conspirator one. Georgia, Michigan, and Nevada have already brought charges against fake electors there, and Wisconsin is still investigating possible charges for its fake electors. Many of those who were indicted in the Arizona case continued to spread misinformation about the 2020 election, claiming that it was stolen from Trump long after the election was over. Senators Hoffman of Queen Creek and Kern of Glendale, as well as the Arizona Republican Party, all responded to the indictments with outrage and accusations of their own. Today's indictments by Attorney General Chris Mays represent a blatant and unprecedented abuse of prosecutorial power aimed solely at distracting the public from the critical policy debates our country should be focusing on as we approach the 2024 election, the AZGOP said in a statement on April 24th. The timing of these charges, precisely 4 years after the 2020 election, and as President Biden seeks re-election, is suspiciously convenient and politically motivated. This is not justice, it is pure election interference. Hoffman, in a statement, espoused his innocence and alleged that Mays timed the handing down of the grand jury indictments to bolster Biden's re-election campaign, calling them, quote, naked political persecution. In his own statement, Kern said he was running for the U.S. House of Representatives this year to ensure that others aren't prosecuted for political reasons. When President Trump called for my aid, I answered, Kern said in a statement. My reward? A crooked Democrat attorney general prosecuting me with 9 fabricated felonies. And that concludes this story. 5 more Trump attorneys' aides publicly named in AZ fake elector indictment. Our next story, 13 allegations of candidate petition signature forgery forwarded for possible criminal charges, by Caitlin Sievers, April 25, 2024. The Arizona Secretary of State's office has referred 13 cases of potential candidate petition signature fraud to the Attorney General for investigation, including allegations that Republican Representative Austin Smith personally forged voter signatures. The Secretary of State's office also pointed out what it said was a glaring case of candidate petition signature forgery, allegedly by a petition circulator for Yuma State Representative Michelle Pena, a Republican. Candidates for elected office in Arizona must collect a certain number of nomination petition signatures from registered voters they hope to represent to qualify for the ballot. The number of signatures required depends on which office the person is running for, but candidates typically attempt to gather at least 30% more signatures than needed because it's a given that some of those signatures will be disqualified. The deadline to file a civil court case challenging the petition signatures gathered for candidates looking to get on this year's July primary ballot was April 15th. In all, 21 challenges were brought against Arizona candidates for the U.S. and state legislatures, and 9 of those candidates have already dropped their bids for office. The challengers, typically they are allied with the candidate's political opponents, must point out to the courts specific signatures that they say are invalid. Many of those individual challenges are aimed at signatures from unqualified voters, such as registered Democrats who sign a Republican's petition, or vice versa, or voters who live outside of the candidate's district. Other challenges might target signatures from a voter who signed the same candidate's petition more than once, or who signed petitions from multiple candidates running for the same office. In the latter case, the petition that the voter signed first is valid and subsequent ones are not. Signatures can also be challenged if they don't belong to a registered voter, if they are illegible, or if the signee didn't date their signature. But the 13 cases that the Secretary of State's office referred to Attorney General Chris Mays include allegations of signature fraud or forgery, which could result in criminal charges. However, J.P. Martin, a spokesman for Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, told the Mirror that it's up to the AG's prosecutors to determine if fraud or forgery occurred and whether to file charges. Richie Taylor, a spokesman for Mays, told the Mirror that no charges had been filed in any of these cases as of April 24th. The most high-profile forgery allegations that could garner criminal charges were leveled against Smith, a Republican state representative from Surprise and a member of the state legislature's far-right Freedom Caucus. Smith announced that he was dropping his bid for re-election just days after the signature challenge was filed by a Democratic precinct committeeman who accused Smith of personally forging the signatures of more than 100 voters. Two voters whose signatures appear on his petition told the court in a sworn statement submitted alongside the challenge that they did not sign the petition. Smith released a two-page statement announcing the end of his campaign, but he never took accountability and blamed Democrats for launching a coordinated attack against him. Photos of petition sheets that Smith circulated himself show full pages of signatures that look as if they were all written by the same person, with handwriting that is strikingly similar to Smith's. And there is an image of this which has appeared in earlier stories about this same matter. In the statement, Smith said that he didn't want to start out his life with his new wife in debt because of costly legal fees to fight the allegations. Although the challenge to his candidacy is moot since he's no longer running for office, he could still face criminal charges of forgery. And though Smith hasn't announced it or removed the job from his social media profiles, the Washington Post reported last week that he had resigned from his job at Turning Point Action, the campaign arm of the far-right Turning Point USA, which is aimed at young Republicans and run by Charlie Kirk. The Secretary of State's office also identified what appeared to be an even more obvious case of signature fraud on Peña's petitions. Even though no one filed a challenge to Peña's signatures, the Secretary of State's office still forwarded its suspicions of fraud to the Attorney General. In an email obtained by the Mirror through a public records request, Lisa Mara, the state's election director, told several other staffers in the office that she suspected possible circulator fraud on some of Peña's petition sheets. And there is a picture here also of one of Peña's petition sheets. All of the petition sheets that Mara highlighted were circulated by a man named Ricky Guthridge, and the 60 signatures that he collected seemed to be obvious forgeries. The signature lines on the petition sheets that he collected differ significantly from the ones collected by other circulators for Peña, in that they almost exclusively consist of single-name signatures. The signatures, printed names and addresses, and dates on Guthridge's petition sheets all feature the same, often illegible, handwriting. And there's a picture of that here as well. Neither Guthridge nor Peña responded to questions from the Arizona Mirror asking if the petition circulator is the same Ricky Guthridge who is president of the University of Arizona College Republicans. But the address of the petition circulator is an off-campus apartment building for students who attend the university. While Peña lives in Yuma, her district also covers part of Tucson. The Guthridge, who attends U of A, is a national committee man for Arizona College Republicans and is on the boards for Pima County Young Republicans and for Turning Point USA's operations at the university. He has been active in supporting candidates like election denier and U.S. Senate hopeful Carrie Lake. Other candidates whose cases were referred to the Attorney General for allegations of fraud are Michael Eaton, a libertarian running for Legislative District 9 in the State House, who has already dropped out of the race and whose civil case has been dismissed. Shante Salisbury, a Democrat running for Legislative District 13 in the House, who was already dropped out of the race and whose civil case was dismissed. Jesus David Mendoza, a Republican running for Congressional District 3 in the U.S. House, whose civil challenge case brought by Shelley Bush, head of the conservative election denier group We the People AZ Alliance, has been dismissed. Isaac Ruiz, a Democrat running for Legislative District 11 in the State House, whose civil case has been dismissed. David Cook, a Republican running for Legislative District 7 in the State Senate, who was challenged by incumbent Republican Wendy Rogers. A judge ruled on Wednesday that enough of his signatures were valid for Cook to remain on the ballot. The judge also found that Rogers provided no proof of signature forgery. Christy Kelly, a Republican running for Arizona Corporation Commission, who has withdrawn from the race. Arturo Hernandez, a Green Party candidate running for U.S. Senate, whose civil case was set for trial on Thursday. Clifford Cast, a Libertarian running for Congressional District 6 in the U.S. House, who has dropped out of the race. Marlene Galan Woods, a Democrat running for Congressional District 1 in the U.S. House, whose civil challenger dropped the challenge after the Maricopa County Recorder's Office found that she had gathered enough signatures. Galan Woods' attorney also refuted the challenger's claims that she participated in signature fraud. Ralph Heap, a Republican running for Legislative District 10 in the State House, whose civil challenge was dismissed, along with three others filed by the same law firm that the Maricopa County Recorder's Office found had made false allegations throughout their petition signature challenge filings. Matt Welsh, a Democrat running for Legislative District 18 in the State Senate, who has already dropped out of the race. Even if a candidate has dropped out of a race, their petition circulators, in some cases the candidates themselves, could still be charged criminally if the Attorney General finds evidence of fraud or forgery. And that concludes this story. 13 allegations of candidate petition signature forgery forwarded for possible criminal charges. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Our next story, in ethics complaint, Republicans accuse two Dems of, quote, insurrection for protesting on the House floor, by Gloria Rebecca Gomez, April 26, 2024. On the same day that Arizona House of Representatives voted to repeal an abortion ban from the 19th century, a trio of anti-abortion Republicans launched an ethics complaint against top Democratic lawmakers who angrily protested an earlier move to block that vote, accusing them of intimidating GOP lawmakers and inciting a riot. On April 9th, the Arizona Supreme Court revived a near-total ban on abortions from 1864, ruling that it trumps a 15-week gestational ban passed in 2022. The decision left GOP lawmakers scrambling, with some fearful of the political repercussions in November, but most unwilling to move against the party's pro-life stance. On Wednesday, Democrats were finally able to peel away three Republican lawmakers to narrowly repeal the law by a vote of 32-28, but that success followed several high-profile failures, including one that culminated in a vehement reaction on the House floor just a day after the state Supreme Court's ruling. When the GOP majority voted to pause the floor session instead of allowing a bill to repeal the 1864 near-total ban to be heard on April 10th, Democrats erupted into loud shouts of protest, yelling, quote, shame, hold the vote, and blood on your hands, and pointing accusingly at Republican lawmakers across the chamber. That display has been repeatedly denounced by Arizona Republicans, who have compared it to insurrectionist behavior and cited it as part of their reasoning for delaying a vote on the repeal for 2 weeks. And on April 24th, the same day the House repealed the 1864 law, Republican Representatives Jacqueline Parker, Barbara Parker, and David Marshall reiterated that criticism in an ethics complaint filed against Democratic Representatives Oscar de los Santos and Annalise Ortiz. The two led their party in excoriating Republicans that day. In their letters to House Ethics Committee Chairman Joseph Chaplick, the trio called for an investigation into de los Santos and Ortiz, accusing them both of disorderly, inappropriate, and disruptive behavior unbecoming of an elected official, and embarrassing to the House of Representatives on a national stage. While Ortiz is only accused of violating the legislature's definition of disorderly conduct, de los Santos, the number two Democrat in the House, is accused of three separate violations, including meeting the legislator's threshold for disorderly conduct and breaking procedural rules and decorum standards governing debate in the chamber. While disorderly conduct isn't a crime under Arizona law, the complaint lodged against de los Santos and Ortiz defines it based on a legal definition from 1910, which describes it as an act that, quote, scandalizes people, is offensive to the public sense of morality, conflicts with the rules around good order and decorum, or is contrary to law. De los Santos, wrote the trio, violated all three of those qualifications when he incited a riot on the House floor and shouted and insulted lawmakers. Because de los Santos began protesting before the chamber could vote on a motion to recess, rather than allowing the repeal bill to be considered, the complaint alleges that he sought to interfere with the legislative process. Given his actions were intended to threaten members and force the House to act in accordance with his will, they could even be characterized as an attempted insurrection, reads the complaint against de los Santos. And there's a copy of this complaint in the article. The complaint against Ortiz includes similar allegations and accuses her of disrespecting Republican lawmakers and exhibiting behavior unbecoming of an elected representative. Also included as evidence of disorderly conduct in the complaint is the duo's disruption of an impromptu press conference held by Republican Representative Matt Gress shortly after the House failed to support his bid to repeal the 1864 near-total ban. Gress, who is seeking re-election in a swing district, pushed for the House to consider the repeal bill on April 10th, but later voted with the rest of the majority party to table the matter instead. While Gress spoke to reporters about his commitment to continue advocating for the repeal on the House floor shortly after the rest of the Republican Party had dispersed in the face of criticism from Democrats, Ortiz and de los Santos, along with other Democrats, approached and accused him of lying and not caring if women died. Gress, Ortiz told reporters, has previously supported bills that have the potential to codify fetal personhood, and his vote to recess the floor session instead of forcing a vote on the repeal bill showcased his insincerity. A picture of Democrats shouting at Gress is included in the complaint, and a reference is made to recording of Ortiz made of the encounter, in which she stated an intent to disrupt Gress's remarks to reporters. As the riot continued, Representative Ortiz participated in the disruption of a press conference by shouting at members from across the floor and charging the personal desks of Republican members, reads the complaint. Her own recording of the encounter captures her statement, "I think we need to disrupt his conference over here," and depicts her charging across the House floor to Representative Gress and engaging in name-calling in front of the press. Gress did not respond to requests for comment on the complaint or about whether he would be willing to testify to support it in an ethics hearing. The complaint added that the angry yelling from Democrats' movement toward Republican lawmakers and De Los Santos, quote, hovering near Republican desks and invading the personal space of some lawmakers, amounted to intimidation. Several members felt that their personal safety could be at risk, and the sergeant-at-arms was approached to ask what he could do. This outburst completely shattered the decorum and civility of the chamber and disgraced every one of its members, reads the complaint. De Los Santos and Ortiz have until May 1 to file written responses. While it's under the purview of the House Ethics Committee whether to take up the investigation, the options for punishing the duo are limited, as final actions against them must be voted on by the entire House. The committee can recommend that the two be censured, which Republicans who hold a one-vote majority can follow up on. But expelling Ortiz or De Los Santos requires a two-thirds supermajority vote, and Democratic support for such a motion will not happen, especially given that De Los Santos has already been the recipient of Republican retaliation after the repeal of the 1864 law. On Wednesday, shortly after the law was successfully struck down by the House, GOP leadership stripped the Levine Democrat of his committee assignments. In an emailed statement, Minority Leader Lupe Contreras denounced the complaints as just another attempt to punish Democrats for spearheading the vote to repeal the 1864 ban and voicing their disapproval of the GOP push to block it. These complaints are nothing more than retaliation against our members who reacted to a clear abuse of the process by a Republican Speaker pro tem who refused to recognize one of our members and instead went forward with a substitute motion to recess the chamber to avoid a vote on the 1864 total abortion ban repeal, Contreras said. In spite of the over-the-top rhetoric in the complaints, that's all this was. The fact that the Speaker has already punished Assistant Leader De Los Santos by stripping him of his committees before an ethics hearing has even taken place only underscores and accentuates the abuse of process. Progressive organizations defended the free speech rights of the two Democrats and highlighted the accusations of insurrection as ironic. Utilizing your First Amendment right to speak out against a Civil War-era abortion ban is democracy in action, Alejandra Gomez, executive director of LUCHA, said in a written statement. This baseless complaint from Arizona Republicans is full of irony, as they themselves have ties to the January 6th insurrection. This is nothing but a desperate attempt to silence dissent and a waste of time and resources. For Ortiz and De Los Santos, the complaints led to a fundraising opportunity. In posts on social media site X, the two criticized the complaints as groundless and asked for help covering their legal costs and bolstering their re-election campaigns. At Representative Annalise Ortiz and I held the line against the extreme 1864 total ban on abortion. Now MAGA Republicans are retaliating by filing meritless ethics complaints against us. Please donate to cover our legal fees and ensure we are both reelected, wrote De Los Santos. When we said shame on you, we spoke for millions. We won't be silenced. Help us fight this, added Ortiz. And that concludes this story. In ethics complaint, Republicans accuse two Dems of insurrection for protesting on the House floor. Next up, AZ Supreme Court rejects plea to reconsider its ruling implementing the 1864 abortion ban by Gloria Rebecca Gomez, April 29, 2024. The Arizona Supreme Court won't reconsider its decision to revive a near-total abortion ban from 1864 that threatens doctors with prison time. Earlier this month, the High Court ruled in a 4-2 majority opinion that the 160-year-old law trumps a 15-week gestational ban passed in 2022, effectively outlawing all abortions in the state. Less than 2 weeks after that ruling was released, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays filed a motion to reconsider with the High Court. Late Friday, the justices shot down that request in a two-sentence court order, but did not give any explanation for the rejection. In their argument for why the Civil War era ban should be Arizona's chief abortion law, the justices relied heavily on a legislative intent clause added to the 2022 law's underlying bill that explicitly stated it doesn't repeal any other laws that came before it, specifically the 1864 law. In her motion to reconsider, Mays argued that the justices had undermined decades of legal precedent and their own judicial record by using sources other than the plain text of the laws to build their argument. The legislative intent clause isn't part of state law. Deviating from standard interpretation practices, Mays warned, would have devastating consequences for future court cases. It's not about a cosmic search for legislative intent, because the words of a statute are the only thing to which the legislature agreed, Solicitor General Joshua Bender wrote on behalf of Mays. A faithful application of this court's longstanding principles of statutory interpretation requires that this pursuit to understand the meaning of the 15-week ban begin and end with its plain language. While the justices in the majority defended their search for legislative intent elsewhere by asserting that the 15-week law is vague because it didn't explain how it fit with the 1864 near-total ban that came before it, Mays argued that its meaning is perfectly clear. Based on a plain reading of its text, according to Mays, the law was crafted to regulate abortions, not virtually ban all of them. Mays' arguments appeared to be compatible with the criticism of the court's ruling in the dissenting opinion. In it, Vice Chief Justice Ann Timmer, joined by Chief Justice Robert Brutinel, disagreed with the majority's premise that the 15-week law is vague, saying that the text is unambiguous. The statute says what it means and means what it says. There is no room for misunderstanding, Timmer wrote. But the rejection of May's motion to reconsider was issued with the approval of all six judges. In an emailed statement, May's spokesman, Richie Taylor, said the Attorney General disagrees with the court's decision and that her office will continue looking into every legal avenue to prevent the 1864 law from taking effect. He added that because the court has yet to issue a final mandate in the case, in part due to the delay caused by May's motion, the re-implementation of the 1864 law has been pushed back 2 more weeks to June 27th. The case is likely to see future litigation as the state Supreme Court charged a lower court with considering constitutional arguments made by reproductive rights advocates. And an effort in the Arizona legislature to repeal the Civil War era law is underway, though that isn't expected to become effective until months after the near-total abortion ban is re-implemented. For now, abortion rights advocates are seeking to delay the law until the November election, when Arizona voters are likely to decide the legality of abortion care via the Arizona Abortion Access Act, which would enshrine the procedure as a right in the state constitution. And that concludes this story. AZ Supreme Court rejects plea to reconsider its rule implementing the 1864 abortion ban. And next, a year of Medicaid unwinding cuts 600,000, but renews nearly 2 million on Arizona's rolls. By Annika Torles of Cronkite News, April 29, 2024. 1 year after restarting the pre-pandemic review process for enrollment in Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System cut coverage for 611,144 recipients and approved 1,953,301 renewals, according to its eligibility dashboard. The agency is continuing to review coverage for 1,892 recipients as of April 5th. The nationwide review process, referred to as, quote, unwinding, cut the Medicaid rolls in every state. State agencies like AHCCCS go through a process every year known as renewal and discontinuous. During this process, recipients' income levels are evaluated to determine if they still qualify for coverage through Medicaid or CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. However, during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act instructed states to suspend disenrollment efforts and extend coverage through March 2023. During this time, Medicaid and CHIP enrollment grew to 92.3 million nationwide, an increase of over 20 million since the beginning of 2020. In Arizona, enrollment grew from 1.9 million to 2.5 million during the pandemic, according to Matt Jewett, Director of Health Policy for the Children's Action Alliance. Despite the unwinding process, over 2.2 million Arizonans still have full or partial coverage through Medicaid or CHIP, around 300,000 more than before the pandemic, as reported in the April 2024 AHCCCS Population Highlights Report. We're happy that the total number of people enrolled is still above what it was before the pandemic started, Jewett said. According to Medicaid, the expiration of continuous enrollment that happened during the pandemic is the single largest health coverage transition since the first open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. AHCCCS, the Arizona agency in charge of Medicaid, reviewed medical criteria and ran 2.5 million Arizonans enrolled in Medicaid through the federal database and income sources to determine eligibility. Medicaid recipients received letters explaining the start of this process and their status, no matter if they were declared eligible or not. There are a lot of people who fell off. Many of them managed to get back on, said Jewett. We don't understand why some of those people lost coverage to begin with. Maybe they did not return their renewal forms on time, or they didn't take action, or it could be some sort of technical or administrative glitches. But it sounds like AHCCCS is doing better than other states. Those who weren't automatically declared eligible or ineligible through the database were informed of their status through email and mail notifications sent out by AHCCCS. It told people to review their information for possible errors and verify that they exceeded the Medicaid income limit. Heidi Capriotti, Communication Administrator for AHCCCS, noted that a main reason for disenrollment was a lack of response from the Medicaid recipient. For many recipients, this was their first experience with the review process, according to Claudia Maldonado, Director of Outreach and Enrollment at the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. Joint communication and outreach from state and local organizations was implemented to help guide recipients through the process. Those that did have to interact often went to maybe a community health center because they knew somebody there who could help them, as all of our health centers have people who are dedicated to helping people with their enrollment and questions and what have you, Maldonado said. Arizona's average automatic renewal rate was 72% throughout the unwinding process that started in April 2023. AHCCCS got information through Equifax, the Department of Motor Vehicles, Medicare, the Social Security Administration, and other sources to automatically verify eligibility and avoid staff intervention. According to the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, Arizona has the second highest ex parte automatic renewal rate in the country. This means that many Medicaid and CHIP recipients went through the renewal process without providing back-and-forth documentation because the AHCCCS was already in possession of necessary documents. "We are one of the highest in the country," said Jennifer Burns, Senior Director of Legislative Affairs at the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. "It's been very rewarding to see how well that went." Burns attributed Arizona's success to the collaboration between the various state agencies, managed care organizations, community health centers, and the community at large. Licensed navigators received lists of those who lost coverage and were available to help those people find coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Maldonado said navigators prioritized community outreach at school-based community resource centers, fairs, and food banks, where they understood the demographics of community members and their needs. Meanwhile, community health centers worked with health plans like Medicaid to further localize outreach. Maldonado at AHCHC participated in media coverage of the unwinding process on Spanish language news and radio. "Every community is different and has its own personality," Maldonado said. "Some of the communities prefer radio and television over social media. So it's understanding those nuances in our communities and then choosing those avenues that we know the messaging will have the greatest impact." After unwinding Medicaid for the first time in years, state and federal agencies will soon begin the review process for the coming year. And that concludes this story, A Year of Medicaid Unwinding, cuts 600,000, but renews nearly 2 million on Arizona's rolls. And it looks like that's all the time we have for this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, thanking you so much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again for more news from the Arizona Mirror next week. Bye-bye.